Welcome to Journal Club for November 6, 2024. I'm Malcolm Dix. If you ever rent an Airbnb out in the desert somewhere, like Joshua Tree, for example, your host is probably going to spend quite a bit of time talking to you about your shoes. Where to put them, how to put them there, where not to put them, what to do before you put them on, and what to do if you ignored the first instructions and accidentally left them somewhere you weren't supposed to leave them. For the uninitiated, you might think this person is completely insane, but they're not. They're telling you all this so that you don't end up getting stung by a scorpion. You see, your Airbnb host, like the vast majority of human beings on the planet, spends their time trying to have as few interactions with scorpions as possible. They stay over here, scorpions stay over there. The end. I think this is true for virtually everybody who lives in scorpion country, except venom researchers. Venom researchers like the ones who authored the study we're looking at today. As you'll see in a moment, the vast majority of this study is totally normal. They use a dataset to train a model. They use part of the dataset for validation. But then, at the point you'd normally use the remaining data to test the model, they do something different. They go out into the wild deserts of Chile, Argentina, and the US and capture scorpions. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Before we get to any of that, we need to ground ourselves in what scorpion toxin is used for and why it's being studied at all. If you're unlucky enough to get stung by a scorpion, you're likely going to experience the following: severe pain at the sting site, swelling and redness around the area, muscle spasms and twitching, difficulty breathing, numbness or tingling sensations, and an increased heart rate and blood pressure. But why? Well, largely because scorpion toxin blocks cell ion channels. It prevents ions like sodium or potassium from moving in and out of the cells like they usually would, which disrupts cell communication and signals throughout the nervous system. At the microscopic level, cell depolarization is delayed, which is causing you to feel pain, numbness, and muscle spasms, and maybe even experience difficulty breathing. Bad stuff. But the thing that makes scorpion toxin so nasty also makes it a powerful candidate for pharmaceutical research. You see, blocking specific ion channels is actually an incredibly useful quality in some medications. When drug companies are able to harness these types of targeted ion channel blockers, they can create drugs that control pain, reduce epileptic seizures, prevent certain cancers from growing, or even improve heart function. But creating scorpion-derived medications is a process that starts not in a giant pharma lab, but in a humble research facility. Before the scorpion toxin could be useful for any of these purposes, it first needs to be categorized. Specifically, the toxin type needs to be categorized as either a potassium channel blocker, sodium channel blocker, or other. And if it's a sodium channel blocker, the specific type of sodium channel it targets needs to be known before it'd be useful for any pharmaceutical company. And that's where venom researchers come in. Generally, the work to be done is to take new samples of scorpion RNA and classify it as one of these groups: inhibitor cysteine knots, potassium channel toxins, sodium channel toxins, or general venom proteins. But that is easier said than done because of how small the peptides are. Peptides are the short sequences of amino acids that actually carry out the toxic effects. When a scorpion is caught out in the field, the researchers collect the venom and extract the RNA. The RNA contains the genetic instructions to create the peptides. So as the researchers sequence the RNA, they're able to project the shape of the peptides that the RNA would result in. The toxin-related peptides, however, are quite short, and that makes them difficult to classify. Traditionally, they use a tool called BLAST, B-L-A-S-T, which works by comparing RNA sequences to known sequences in a database to find similarities. But with short peptides, this tool has some major shortcomings. Namely, it often misclassifies or overlooks peptides due to limited sequence length. So today's researchers set out to create a better way. Instead of using BLAST to classify scorpion RNA, they decided to train an artificial neural network to do it instead. If they were successful, the neural net would allow them to input an RNA sequence and get a toxin classification as output. Let's see where they got their data, how they trained their model, how they tested it, and how well it worked. Well, the first thing to note is that they actually trained two models. One model to differentiate between venom-related and non-venom-related RNA, and one model to categorize the type of toxin. You can think of it as a two-stage classifier. The simpler model just classifies general talks and presence, so we'll focus most of our analysis on the more complex model, the one designed for detailed toxin type classification. They created a dataset from publicly available scorpion venom sequences in the UniProt database, along with some specific scorpion venom studies. In addition, they created a second dataset focused on toxins affecting only insects, only mammals, or both. This allowed them to train additional models for more nuanced classification. They divided the data into 75% for training and 25% for validation. The training itself was done using Python and TensorFlow libraries with a supervised learning algorithm called sparse categorical cross-entropy loss. The loss function is designed to help models distinguish between similar categories by penalizing incorrect classifications more harshly as training progresses. This helps the model produce clear distinctions between the categories, especially helpful here because the venom peptides had high structural similarity. The researchers also used a custom dropout layer called INT dropout, which randomly masks residues before embedding, reduces overfitting, and further enhances classification accuracy. To optimize training, they use an algorithm called ADAM Optimizer. It's also called Adaptive Moment Estimation. ADAM combines ideas from momentum-based optimization and RMS prop, allowing it to balance speed and stability during training. It works by keeping track of the average of past gradients, so that's like momentum, to smooth updates, making it less likely to get stuck on local irregularities. Additionally, it adapts the learning rate for each parameter based on past gradients, adjusting more aggressively for those parameters that change frequently and more slowly for those that are stable. By using adaptive learning rates, ADAM efficiently finds the optimal weight configuration for the model, allowing it to converge faster while maintaining accuracy across different classes. So now they had their trained models, but they had used 75% of their data for training and 25% for validation. Usually when you're training a model, you don't do this. You generally use something like an 80-10-10 split, meaning 80% of your data for training, 10% for validation, and 10% for testing. But after using 75-25, they didn't have any data left to actually test the model. And for these researchers, that was all part of the plan, because they didn't want to test their model on previously available data. They wanted to test their model on real scorpions. And that's how a bunch of researchers ended up roaming around the deserts of Argentina, Chile, and the US looking for scorpions. And they caught three of them. Once caught, they used an RNA extraction kit to extract the RNA, then sequence the RNA using Illumina sequencing. Then they used this data as input into their new model to test it out. In validation, the model achieved over 90% accuracy in identifying sodium and potassium channel toxins and around 80% accuracy in distinguishing ICK toxins. In testing, the model successfully identified most toxin categories but had challenges with borderline cases where the structural differences were subtle. Variability in sequence data and the limited samples for rarer toxin types introduced some noise into the results, contributing to lower accuracy in those classes. So, what can we take away from this paper? Narrowly, well, that scorpion toxins can now be classified with neural networks, but I'm betting there's little chance that that's useful information for you. So, broadly, I think the most useful part of this paper for most software engineers is going to be their no-frills approach to training their neural net. A lot of times we overcomplicate things. These researchers didn't, and because they didn't, they were able to get results quickly. Of course, they can now iterate on it. They can modify the architecture, adjust the learning rate, and increase the data set over time, but they got their initial model out the door, working reasonably well. And in a world where so many ML projects get bogged down by complexity and fanciness and miss their ship dates because they're trying to reinvent the wheel, maybe this simplicity is an example we can all follow. Just train something simple, ship it, and iterate. Get the model out the door, and make it better later. Thank you for joining me on today's episode of Journal Club. I hope you enjoyed it. Malcolm Diggs signing off. See you tomorrow.